This time on your weekly constitutional, caps on damages in personal injury cases.
The legislative record is vacant on what is the public benefit of this cap. And I mean, particularly when, you know, one of the things you look at, a cap on damages like this applies only to the people who are most severely injured. You're not talking about people with cut fingers. In order for a jury to award an amount more than the cap amount, somebody suffered very serious injury.
That was appellate attorney John Vail, who recently argued an important torts case in front of the Tennessee Supreme Court. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's your weekly constitutional.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Every year for the past 5 years, or maybe more, I've had the privilege of speaking to the East Tennessee branch of the Tennessee Trial Lawyers Association. We talk about legal ethics. In fact, it's a lengthy presentation at the beautiful Carnegie Hotel in downtown Johnson City, and it's all about legal ethics. And over the years, I have met a number of wonderful people. Hello, Tony. Hello, Suzanne. Hello, Teresa. Hello, all the rest of you East Tennessee lawyers. And we have a good time. One of the most interesting people I've met through my connections with the trial lawyers is a guy by the name of John Vail. Now, John has had a long and interesting career, as you'll hear in a moment. But right now what he does is he argues appeals. That is, he goes in front of banks of three or maybe five or more appellate judges. He submits briefs, and sometimes he does oral arguments, and these are in some very important cases. Today, John is going to tell us about one he recently argued in front of the Tennessee Supreme Court involving the ever-controversial subject of tort reform.
My name is John Vail. I am a lawyer. I began my career up here in East Tennessee, working at Legal Aid in Johnson City. Mm-hmm. I worked at Legal Aid programs in different places for about 17 years.
So you're going for the bucks.
Exactly.
Exactly. I hate greedy lawyers.
And wound up moving to Washington, D.C. to work at a national program, the Center for Law and Education, to do education law work. And it was there about a year when it went under, or almost went under, and several of us had to leave because we didn't have any money, and I had to find a job. And I wound up working at becoming the senior counsel for constitutional litigation for the Association of Trial Lawyers of America.
Wait a minute. That sounds like a pretty heavy-duty role for what's – well, I guess you've been out 17 or 18 years at that point.
I have.
Okay. So you'd gotten the experience. Okay, good.
And I had experience – I had a lot of my volunteer work was – I had done a lot of work with ACLU. I had been president of the board of the ACLU of North Carolina and then subsequently became the president in Virginia. When we moved there, we live in Virginia, work in Washington. So I took the job with the trial lawyers to work on cases involving access to justice, the right to access to justice, which is often not recognized but is very plainly and accurately a First Amendment right, part of the right to petition in the First Amendment, mm-hmm. and the right to jury trial, the Seventh Amendment to the federal Constitution. But we also –
Let's just pause there. You're exactly right. We have a court system. And everybody has a right to utilize that court system. It's extremely important. And there are barriers to that access. And so that's what you were trying to overcome.
That's right. And I've always found it very consistent with my work in legal aid, which was often about access to justice, about getting into court and having people get into court and be allowed to do it.
I'm so glad you did that, because so many people have the misapprehension that litigation is somehow a bad thing. Now, I'm not saying it's a pleasant thing. And it's certainly an expensive thing most of the time, and it can be lengthy and frustrating and difficult. But it's not inherently a bad decision to go to court if you have been wronged, if there's something that you need redressed. I mean, that's an essential part of our system of government. I recall years ago when my wife and I practiced in Florida, we recommended to a client that she file a lawsuit. And she said, but I can't sue another Christian. She had been fed this idea that perhaps because of a particular religious persuasion – or perhaps just because suing somebody was such an aggressive act that she couldn't do it. It wasn't available to her. And that, I think, is an unfortunate mindset. It's not a first resort, but it certainly is something to do as a last resort if you have to.
Well, I can illustrate its fundamental importance, Stuart. We both know about the social contract and how constitutions come into existence. So when you're there in the state of nature where life is nasty, brutish, and short.
Mm-hmm. That's me, nasty, brutish. But go on, please.
And somebody steals your cow, what are your options? You know, you can go fight about it, or you can let it go, or what? You don't have an authority. And one of the reasons people entered the social contract, left the state of nature, was to create a mechanism where you could resolve civil disputes like that without resort to violence.
Precisely.
Litigation is the alternative to fighting it out. And there's been, I'd say over the last 40, 50 years, there's been a propaganda war about litigation, well-funded, well-recognized by, you know, funded, put out by corporate America to say, no, going to court is a horrible thing. That's a lot. Litigation is horrible. And it's not. And, you know, in a jury trial, the culmination of litigation in our system is, you know, it's not a failure of any dispute resolution. It's the pinnacle of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's what it was designed for.
If you think about it, it's two people who might be inclined to hit each other, instead going to a neutral arbiter who is learned in the law, that's the judge, and then in appropriate cases submitting the factual judgment at least to a jury of their peers, people just like them, who could sit and listen and use their judgment, and then to reach a resolution where nobody punches anybody else, and we hope that something close to justice is done.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, the jury mechanism in this, because we're going to talk about that, is important because it's a thing that gives the whole system legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not just going to some fairly well up in the air elite to resolve your dispute. You're going to have 6 or 12 of people who are or could be your neighbors in there really making the critical judgments about the resolution of the case. And that's one of the reasons that people accept the verdicts that the system renders and the judgments that the system renders.
Even when they don't like it.
It gives them a political legitimacy to say, you know, I may not like that, but it's what the folks around me think, and so be it.
And you took this position some years ago with the American Association of Trial Lawyers, which is generally considered a plaintiff's group, right? A plaintiff's It's a plaintiff's lawyers group, and the plaintiff's lawyers are the ones who are most often demonized, as you say, by the people who have an interest in not being sued, insurance companies, large corporations. And so I used to tell lawyer jokes that typically focused on greedy plaintiff's lawyers. I don't typically do that anymore because I think that's part of the propaganda campaign. But I want to finish discussing you and then we'll go on from that. So you American Association of Trial Lawyers. How long did you do that?
Well, we were there for a couple of years and the people who did that spun off a little law firm called the Center for Constitutional Litigation. And I was the vice president of it. And I was there for about 15 years. It still exists in much reduced form. And at one point late in life, I just decided that I didn't want an institutional affiliation with anything. I just wanted to be my own boss. So now I still have a one-person national appellate practice. I do a lot of the same kind of work related to access to justice and the right to jury trial. I have the privilege of working with a fellow that I call America's leading anti-terrorism lawyer, Tom Fay. We represent victims of terrorism. We have big judgments on behalf of the Marines and estates of Marines and Marine family members who were injured as a result of the 1983 Beirut barracks bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still
trying to— And that was a terrible situation.
And we're trying to collect those judgments. We won a case in the Supreme Court a couple of years ago that allowed us to seize our share was about $1.8 billion of seized Iranian assets and distribute those to the Marine families. I can sleep at night doing that work.
Oh, absolutely.
That's just fine.
Let's define a couple of things for people, because you say you're an appellate lawyer, which I think is a wonderful career path. Trial lawyers, whom I also respect, they have the initial job of taking a case to a trial court, and it's an enormously complex thing involving lots and lots of interactions with lots of people, gathering up of evidence, all these sorts of things, arguing motions, etc. And then, of course, a trial itself, unless it's settled. But then once that trial is over, typically the losing party has the option of filing an appeal. And there's a big misconception that we're just going to have a do-over. Well, a do-over can result from an appeal, but an appeal is not essentially that. An appeal is making an argument to a higher court, typically composed of three judges, no jury, three judges, that the trial court made some kind of error and that that error needs to be corrected, and ideally the appealing party will get a reversal of the judgment below. There are a variety of things that can happen, but that's the difference. And the difference in the practice, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that essentially you get cases after there's been some sort of judgment in a trial court, and it's your job to sit down and figure out what errors might have been made, and then you write something called an appellate brief, which is a big process. And then the other side does, and maybe you respond to it. And then after some months of going back and forth with your written arguments, you may have an oral argument that is argued. And to my mind, that is the pinnacle of law practice, because it involves all the big issues. It involves arguing on your feet. It involves responding very quickly to sometimes hostile questions. And that's basically what you've been doing for a few years, isn't it?
Well, it's what I've been doing for a lot of years, but I'd broaden it a little bit. I'd say, you know, what I do, because sometimes I'm involved in trials too. What I do, trial lawyers in general are the people who develop facts. They find out what the facts are and they present them to the fact finder. It's my job, if I'm working in the trial court, to tell the fact finder what the legal consequences of those facts should be. And that's the same on appeal. On appeal, the kind of appeals I do in general, you have fewer disputes about facts on appellate level. You have some and they're important. But primarily what you're doing is saying, okay, now that we know what the facts are, what are the consequences of those? What does the law require in reaction to that set of facts?
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to go back a second to one theme that we talked about. We talked about trial lawyers and what they do. And I talked about the, you know, a corporate campaign against litigation. You see now, there's also a campaign against journalists.
Yeah.
And what's the function of journalists?
Keep politicians honest and keep the public informed.
And they do that by generating facts.
Mm-hmm.
Trial lawyers generate facts. Journalists generate facts.
So it's a war on facts.
Both of them are under attack.
Yeah.
Because they are the two independent sources of factual information. They're not beholden to corporate America. They're not beholden to the state. And I think that helps illustrate why that war is so dangerous to us now.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my guest today is appellate attorney John Vail, who's been talking to us about access to justice and about his career representing the little guy. Listening to you, Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's return to our discussion with appellate attorney John Vail, who is telling us about, well, he will eventually tell us about a case he recently litigated in the Tennessee Supreme Court, but we've got lots of other interesting things to cover in the meantime.
So you've worked in your solo appellate practice for years, and indeed that's how you and I met. We met some years back because I have a very happy association with the Tennessee branch of the Association of Trial Lawyers, the Tennessee Association of Trial Lawyers. And, of course, Tony Seaton, our mutual friend, has arranged – well, he's been on the show several times talking about things like access to justice. And he arranged for me some years ago to start giving a three-hour ethics CLE every December. And we just recently had the pleasure of encountering each other at that one. And you reminded me that there's a very important case that has been percolating up that indeed Tony and I have talked about before in its earlier phases involving something called caps on tort damages. So what can you tell me about this case?
Well, let's define the issue. In the legislature passed a statute that said the in brief, we don't have to go into details about the statute because it's more complex than this.
It's the Tennessee legislature. We're talking about
the Tennessee legislature.
And let me put that in context. Tort law, the law of personal injury, is almost entirely a matter of state law. It's not something that the feds get involved in that much. I mean, there's a Federal Tort Claims Act and all the rest of it. But for the most part, the body of tort law is on a local level, and most tort cases are civil cases in the state courts. So when the state of Tennessee changes its tort law, which it can, it's generated both by judges' opinions and by the legislature, then we are focused on the state of Tennessee and the state of Tennessee's constitution as well as the national constitution.
That's correct.
Okay.
So the Tennessee legislature passed a statute that said that the most amount of money you could recover for non-economic damages – now that's the statutory language. I want to come back to that.
Okay.
Is $750,000. Now, non-economic damages, I think, is a pejorative term because when you talk about these kinds of damages, you talk about – one of the great criticisms of them is you can't – you know, there's not objective standards to relate them to. They, you know, you can't – go in and look at the wage records and say, well, if they had worked for this 6 months, they would have earned X dollars.
That's an economic damage.
That's right.
If I get injured and I can't work for 6 months and all you have to do is figure out what my monthly salary is and that's how much work I've missed and that's my economic damage, relatively easy to quantify. Okay, so right. Everyone is on the same page. But non-economic is different.
Non-economic damages are more often referred to commonly as pain and suffering damages. Mm-hmm. And they don't have that kind of record. You can't just look at them that way. But one of the ways I talk about it is to say, you know, there's a reason we don't have that because of our culture and because of our ethics, we don't allow a marketplace in injuries. We don't allow people to sell their limbs. We don't allow people to sell their children. We don't allow people to sell their capacity to reproduce. And those are cultural norms rooted largely in faith-based ideas.
Mm-hmm. And there are libertarian arguments to allow all of those things.
That's right.
I mean, there are. I mean, there's a debate.
Sure. The law reflects the culture. The law seldom drives a culture. The law adapts to the way people are primarily. It can have some changing effects, and particularly in the economic sphere. But way back when, remember tort law is old. Remember we talked about its origins.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things we're going to talk about, these constitutional things we'll talk about, you know, flow from Magna Carta, and they flow from common law existed before Magna Carta. But the idea was that we knew people got hurt, and we knew that some of the damages that we incurred are not measured in the marketplace. So we needed an alternative mechanism to give valuation for them as a result of our not allowing there to be a market in them.
If we had a market, we could say your left arm is worth X number of dollars.
Worth X number of dollars.
Right.
But we also recognize that the same kind of injury could cause different pain to different kinds of people, or literally just different pain in different people. That's the way their bodies respond. So we demanded two things as a matter of justice. We demanded an individualized determination. We didn't have an across-the-board determination that a left arm is worth $500,000.
Mine's worth more than that, much more.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We did it And the mechanism we created for evaluating that is the jury and trial by jury, where people submit different facts. You know, I once spoke on these issues before the National Convention of Neurosurgeons, and the neurosurgeons were very much in favor of limitations on these kinds of damages. And there was a proposal extant at the time that there be a limit of $500,000, and the neurosurgeons were generally in favor of that. And I think there were about 3,000 neurosurgeons at this convention. You know, I'm the guy who's supposed to walk in there and tell them, no, this is a bad idea. You know, I made sure there was an exit behind me. But I posed a question. I said, if you lost the capacity to have sex, would $500,000 be sufficient compensation? Everybody who says yes raised their hands. And not one of 3,000 neurosurgeons raised their hand, to no surprise. So the Tennessee legislature, in its wisdom, enacted this cap on damages. And lawyers who represented injured plaintiffs were not happy about it. And they wanted to question the constitutionality about it. Now, I've been involved in a number of similar cases in other states. A famous one I lost, if anyone has seen the documentary Hot Coffee about the McDonald's coffee case.
That was you.
Well, McDonald's wasn't, but the case, the medical malpractice case from Nebraska, the Gorley case in there was me. The Jamie Lee Jones case in there was me also.
By the way, that is an excellent documentary. If you're interested in what we're talking about today, it is it describes exactly how cases have been misrepresented, how plaintiffs and their lawyers have been depicted as greedy, when in fact the pain and the suffering was real and the culpability of the defendants was well established. So Hot Coffee is the name of the documentary. I believe it's available online.
And I believe it's on Netflix.
Yeah. I think it is. So you can get it if you've got a subscription. It won't cost anything more. I've seen it. It's excellent. And it is, I will warn you, somewhat jarring because they show what sort of damages the poor woman who had the hot coffee poured in her lap, what she damaged. And her damage was extensive. But at any rate, please go on.
So there was a lawyer in Chattanooga whom I had known for some time who had a case and wanted to challenge the constitutionality of the caps. And engaged me to work with him on that. And we went down there. And it was a horrible case. I mean, basically, the facts of it is the a person who worked for a very large major corporation was driving a company car from one job to another on the interstate near Chattanooga and did not recognize that traffic had stopped dead for, I believe it was an accident, it may have been construction. But in any case, rear-ended somebody at about 70 miles an hour and rendered him paraplegic. And, you know, obviously the injuries were horrible. And in that case, the corporation was ready to admit its liability in that case. It was going to fight about how much damages it owed, which is not uncommon in personal injury litigation. Both of us, both the plaintiff and the defendant, preferred to have a ruling on the constitutionality of the caps because if the cap was upheld, the maximum they'd be liable for in non-economic damages would be $750,000.
And let's just pause there. Think about it. You're in an accident. Your economic damages, what you would have been able to make working, you can get those. Your medical bills, you can get those. But then the suffering of suddenly losing the ability to walk or to move around or perhaps to use the bathroom on your own, that's going to be capped at $750.
That's it.
Okay.
The ability to read, the ability to, you know.
Right.
And the state intervened in that case, which is normal also and appropriate, to defend the constitutionality of the act of the legislature. And the trial judge in Chattanooga, conservative Republican trial judge, I would note, and a very good judge. I watched him in court, and a judge who evidently had great respect for juries. As I'll note for folks out there, that most people, lawyers and judges, plaintiff and defense side, who do work with juries, have immense respect for the jury system. The respect for juries is not a partisan issue among lawyers or judges. It is a very real thing born of experience, of watching lay people come together, called to perform a civic duty, and performing it remarkably well. Lawyers who deal with juries will tell you that juries are good at what they do, and there's an extensive academic literature about juries and how they perform, and it finds the same thing. The jurors take their work very seriously. They follow instructions from judges, and they do their very best to render an honest verdict. And after they do so, they are fans of the jury system, no matter how hard they might have fought at the beginning not to be put onto a jury, which is our most common reaction to a call for jury service.
Look, it's not convenient. It never comes at a convenient time. It costs you time, perhaps costs you money, even though you're supposed to get some small compensation for your time. It is one of the most important civic duties we have as Americans. And I was once called and was disappointed when I was not selected when they found out I was a lawyer, et cetera. So I would encourage everybody to dutifully fulfill that obligation.
As would I. And I think if you are called, you will find it's a remarkable experience. So we litigated that case, and the Tennessee Supreme Court, the state appealed it to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And the Tennessee Supreme Court vacated that case on a procedural ground.
May I interrupt you, please, John?
Yeah.
What amount of damages did the jury award before the cap was imposed?
There was no award in this case.
Oh.
And that was the point. The Supreme Court said, if you decide this legal issue of the constitutionality of the cap, we'll settle this case.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be a trial. But the Supreme Court said, no, there needs to be a verdict before we will resolve this case. So we're vacating this ruling. And then a case came up in Nashville, medical malpractice case with the lawyer Randy Kennard there, a very well-known plaintiff's lawyer and well-respected, well-liked in Nashville. And they got a verdict that exceeded the cap in that case. And Randy called and said, can we do this case? So we briefed that case. And that case had got decided against us by a trial judge. And we're in the Court of Appeals on that case. That case is still pending in the Court of Appeals. When there was a verdict in federal court in Nashville in a personal injury case that exceeded the cap. And the parties—
Just a minute. I have to explain that. As we said, most of these tort cases are going to be in state court. But there is a way into federal court if the plaintiff and the defendant are from different states. And so I'm guessing it's called diversity jurisdiction. Was this a diversity case?
It was a diversity case. It involved a woman who, in fact, the injury happened at the Nashville airport when the woman was traveling from out of state to and from Nashville. And it was a freak injury that caused freak results. A sign fell on her.
Oh, my. Just a minute here, a little bit more down in the weeds. In such a situation where there's diversity jurisdiction, a federal judge who is called upon to decide this case, pursuant to a doctrine called the Erie Doctrine, and that we're not going to go into that.
No.
Most law students still don't understand that, and it takes some professors take a semester to explain it. But in the simplest form I can say is that if I'm a federal judge sitting in Tennessee and a diversity case comes to me with a plaintiff from out of state and a defendant in state, and the plaintiff is suing under state law, a tort law, then in all likelihood, I'm going to apply the state law of Tennessee in my federal courtroom. So this is a federal judge applying state law. Okay, so that's why we're talking about Tennessee tort law.
Exactly.
I'm glad I got that right. I've been teaching that for 20 years, so I'm so glad I got it right my first try.
But there's also, as a result of this, and the Erie Doctrine has to do with federalism in general and respect for state law in the federal courts. And because of the Erie Doctrine, there's a mechanism by which, now generally a federal judge is just going to try a case and apply Tennessee law, and that's going to be it. They can apply Tennessee law. But the Supreme Court of Tennessee is always the final arbiter of what Tennessee law is. That's their it's not a function even of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right.
It's a function of the Supreme Court of Tennessee. And because we have this respect for – this federalism respect, this respect for state law, there's a mechanism by which if a federal judge encounters what's really a big question of state law, the federal judge can ask the state Supreme Court to decide that question. Now, this federal judge saw this is legitimately – a big question of Tennessee law. It's a question of interpreting the Tennessee Constitution on a matter of some moment. So the federal judge certified to the Tennessee Supreme Court three questions about the constitutionality of the Tennessee damages cap. Did it violate the right to jury trial as recognized by the Tennessee Constitution, separate from the Seventh Amendment? Did it violate the separation of powers? And did it violate the right to equal protection of the laws? Again, under the Tennessee Constitution, under Tennessee constitutional doctrine.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is appellate attorney John Vail. We're talking about a very important case recently heard by the Tennessee Supreme Court involving tort reform. But as we've heard, the case had a long and convoluted trail before it got before Tennessee's highest court. Now let's finish our discussion with appellate attorney John Vail. We're talking about a very important case recently litigated before the Tennessee Supreme Court. But before that case could get there, it actually made its way up to the federal system. And the federal judge then referred it through a process called certification to the Tennessee Supreme Court for reasons that John was explaining just before the break.
And I will give props to the federal judge. He was doing, or she was doing, exactly the right thing. This is an important case. It's not a run-of-the-mill tort case. I'm not just interpreting and following Tennessee precedent here. I don't want to usurp the power of the Tennessee Supreme Court, so I'm going to ask the Tennessee Supreme Court to tell me how I should follow the law.
Right, and at least invite it to answer these questions, which are open questions of Tennessee law. And I agree. I think it was a wholly appropriate use of the certification power that the federal judge has. And then the lawyer in that case was in touch, and I got engaged to work on that case, and we wrote briefs for the Tennessee Supreme Court addressing those three certified questions. And I guess you want me to talk about them.
Please do. Please do.
Well, let's start with the right to jury trial, which we've talked about and fleshed out a little bit here. There is a history in this country, and there's a literature in this country documenting that history that shows very clearly that through the 19th century, the right to sit on a jury was considered at least the equivalent in value to the right to vote. And for most of the century, and go back to the 18th century, it was probably considered the more important of the two things. Because remember, you had a dispersed population. the jury was a primary mode of local governance. You know, you were out there in small places where people settled disputes with violence. And remember, as we said before, the jury was the alternative to violence. And the right to sit on a jury, we don't think about that much as one of our constitutional rights, but it is. That history has swept us by in our modern era, but it's one that I, my colleagues and I at the Center for Constitutional Litigation and I have had done a lot of work to unearth and talk about more, write about, both in academic literature and in, you know, in briefs before courts, to remind courts, no, this is the right to jury trial is not an afterthought. It's one of the real fundamental things that was designed to hold this body politic together. So we look historically at who has had the function of deciding damages in tort cases, and it's the jury. And it's that has always been a function of the jury. The evaluation of how much a plaintiff was owed after it was decided that a plaintiff was owed something was solely the province of the jury. So much so that not even the courts were allowed to question it. There is a mechanism in the law whereby a trial judge who sits on a case and thinks that a jury has just awarded an outrageously high amount of money. Let's just say that you had a broken finger and the jury awarded $1 million. The judge could say, you know, that's outrageous. I'm not going to allow it to happen. Plaintiff, you have a choice. I will enter judgment for $100,000 and you can walk away from this court with $100,000, or we will have another trial before a different jury because it strikes me that this jury was inflamed by passion and prejudice is a common standard under the law.
There's a fancy Latin term for this, remittitur.
Remittitur. Right. And it actually, it seldom does, but it there's a term called additur.
Yeah, you never see that.
That doesn't happen much.
Okay, but look, I want to pause here and emphasize. The power to determine the size of the judgment, it rests entirely with people who were in the room, in the courtroom, who heard all the evidence firsthand, who have been able to sit there and look at the plaintiff through these days or weeks of trial and evaluate in a firsthand, common sense way what that person has felt and suffered. So even if the judge modifies the judgment of the jury, the judge has also seen this stuff. That's completely different from an arbitrary cap, isn't it?
Well, that's completely different in that way and in one other way, because the judge has no power to reduce the award absolutely. The judge just offers a choice.
Right.
You can take this money now or you can take another shot with another jury.
So the jury is still preserved, the power of the jury.
The power of the jury is still respected.
With a remittitur, okay.
And with a cap, it's not. It's absolute.
Right. And that leads us directly to the next issue of separation of powers. Okay, please, go ahead. What a great segue. Go on.
That is one of the questions. Now, we have asserted that the jury is part of the judiciary. It performs a function that's judicial. One way, one distinction to be made between legislation and litigation is that litigation deals with particular cases and legislation deals with general cases.
Right.
And we've said that this kind of resolution is for the judiciary. We traditionally have said that this is an individualized determination, that it's performed by the jury, And when the jury performs that function, it's performing a judicial function which the legislature has no power to invade.
Right.
The counterargument that's made is that, no, the legislature is just changing the law. The jury's job is to decide the case within the parameters of the law. And when the jury decides it, the judge then applies the law. And if the jury decides that they want to give the person $1 million, the judge just applies the law and says, well, the only thing you can do is give them $750,000. Now, I don't find that a particularly satisfying paradigm to look at it, but that's the counterargument.
And just to expand on that a little, the legislature of Tennessee or any other state can, in fact, modify tort law in other ways. I mean, for example, concepts of contributory negligence or comparative negligence, which can fundamentally affect the outcome of a case, that's pretty squarely within the power of a legislature, isn't it?
Well, that's another conversation.
let's just say it happens.
It happens.
It happens. Okay,
it happens. So and it's clearly less controversial than this one, which has the more direct impact on what the citizen jurors do.
In an individual case, right. So it's less to do with the jury. Okay, there's a distinction.
Now, the state in the McClay case argued that the jury is not a part of the judiciary. I don't think that's right, but the state did argue that point. so there's this question of, you know, how does the right to jury trial and this right to separation of – and this idea of separated powers cabin the power of the general power of the legislature over tort law? And that's what's at issue here. Now, there was – and separation of powers, remember, is a very big idea.
Right. It's, the legislature has its realm and the judiciary has its realm.
And we say this is in the realm of individualized determinations. We want individualized determinations of this. If we wanted a schedule of damages, we could have had one. But it's antithetical to the idea of citizen decision-making mm-hmm. in this regard. Now, the state also argued that this is really a policy question and that policy questions are for the legislature to decide. And I agree that in a certain sense it's a policy decision, but juries make policy decisions. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of other places in the law where policy decisions, proximate cause being the most common one, that's well recognized in the law to be a policy decision, but it's for jurors to do. And importantly, historically, it always has been for jurors to do. When
you use the word policy, and I notice that law students have difficulty with that. What we're talking about here is making a decision that goes beyond just this case, that where a juror or a legislator in appropriate cases would say, well, if we decide this case this way, what will that mean for the state as a whole? So there's an argument that the legislature is the body that's supposed to be thinking of the state as a whole in other cases. But as you point out, juries also can deliberate on that question.
And we have a 1,000-year history of juries doing that through the administration of the common law.
Mm-hmm.
See, one idea that invades here, there's an extant idea that courts should not make law, which is
– courts make law all the time.
Well, it's a ridiculous idea.
It
is. It's an idea that was propounded popularly about – the federal courts,
mm-hmm.
because indeed the framers didn't want the federal courts to be common law courts. They went out of their way to make sure they were not common law courts. And that's because they didn't want the federal organ making law for the states. This was a federalism question.
Right.
The framers were common lawyers. They recognized that state courts would make state law. And they would make state tort law in particular.
That's a shocking notion for many people. It's something we talk about in our orientation at law school. Common law is judge-made law, and it's inevitable. If I'm a judge and I'm presented with an issue for which there is no statute, then by deciding that issue in this one case, I have set a precedent that may very well be followed by other judges. Even if there is a statute, there may be an issue that's not clear under that statute. You can go A or you can go B. I decide to go B. Okay, now there is a precedent that other judges may follow to go B rather than A. And that's so it's inevitable that judges make these decisions.
And it's a different way of lawmaking. It's reactive, not prospective.
Right.
And it's interstitial, not sweeping.
Right.
It's the slow generation of experience and figuring out how to respect that experience and apply it to a new situation. And again, it's how this kind of law has been made for 1,000 years in the Anglo-American system.
You're absolutely right, John. And I have to interrupt you now because we've got a third issue we need to discuss, and we're running a little short on time. We've discussed the three arguments. The first one is that a jury is a constitutional right in and of itself. The second one is separation of powers. The third one you've mentioned is equal protection. So tell me how that one's implicated here.
Okay. Let's start with the basic equal protection paradigm. Equal protection says that people who are similarly situated should be treated similarly by the law. And we've had experience with this. And generally, for regular kind of things, you have to make decisions all the time in passing legislation that's going to cause one group of people to be treated differently from another. And the general test for equal protection is that if there's a rational basis for the legislature doing what it does, that's okay.
Prime example, state law, you have to have a certain degree of vision before you can drive a car.
Exactly.
That clearly discriminates against blind people. And yet, is it rational to exclude blind people from driving cars? And don't talk to me about Google self-driving cars. Talk to me about cars as they exist now. Of course it's rational. Okay, so we're treating two different groups of people differently, but we have a reason to do so.
But then we have different situations that are more sensitive. And those are generally situations where we have a legislature that's treating a group of people differently, a group of people who have been underrepresented in mm-hmm. the political process, so that their concerns have not been given the same weight in the legislature. And we judicially were willing to be more suspicious of those and look harder behind them. And there are varying ways to say this, but you have a higher degree of scrutiny of the legislator, what the legislature did. And you might require that the legislature have a compelling interest in order to treat people differently. Or intermediately, you might say, we're going to look at this harder and we want to make sure that if we're going to have this result, that this disfavored group of people, and this could be people of color, mm-hmm. women, people who have been underrepresented in the political process, we want to make sure that the means justify the ends.
Right.
And it's a more subjective inquiry for a court, and courts are more hesitant, but they're saying, no, to give content to this idea of equal protection, we need to do a little more when disfavored groups are on the hook.
And race and gender are two of those particular groups.
Two of those things.
Who is the disfavored group in this situation?
Well, it's women.
Seriously?
Seriously.
These caps hurt women more than men.
There is a very good academic literature showing upon empirical analysis that caps like this, caps on non-economic damages, take more away from women than they do from men. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One has to do with how women traditionally have been undervalued in the workplace. So if a woman is a homemaker –
Oh, that's right. Her economic damages are going to be much lower.
Right. If she'd been in paid work for that, she could claim that as economic damages.
Right.
Now, it's the same work.
Right.
But she has to claim it as non-economic damages.
Okay. I see your point.
And another is that it turns out that women suffer certain kinds of injuries disproportionately to men that are compensated by non-economic damages. And an obvious one among those is damage to reproductive capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Women who have exposure to different kind of chemicals and that kind of thing. It's a, you know, it's a physical system that women have that men don't.
Okay. The plumbing's different. Therefore, the damages are different.
And women suffer those injuries more than men do. So, I think that's empirically well established. And then there's the question of what degree of scrutiny should it get from the courts. And the general rule is a rational basis. And we've said when you have what's called a disproportionate impact, we can show that this has a disproportionate impact on women. Can we show that the legislature sat there and said, if we do this, we're going to get those women out there?
Yeah, that's the hard one to prove. And I'll just interject that generally speaking, the rule is that you have to show both effect and intent to cause the harm. So you've got a hard argument there.
Well, we've said that we don't claim to be able to show intent, but we claim this middle ground that says, but we do show this impact, and it impacts this group known to be disfavored, known to have been underrepresented in the political process. Therefore, greater scrutiny is in order, and it's legitimate to look at what you actually get out of this. And the legislative record is vacant on what you really, what is the public benefit of this case, of this cap. And I mean, particularly when, one of the things you look at, a cap on damages like this applies only to the people who are most severely injured.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
you're not talking about people with cut fingers.
Right.
In order for a jury to award an amount more than the cap amount, somebody suffered very serious injury.
Right, and disproportionately those are women. Yeah. Well, I hate to cut this short, John, but I do want to finish that you had your oral argument on this recently. In early September of 2019.
The case is pending decision.
Okay, pending decision. Well, crystal ball me now. Tell me, what's your sense from seeing the justices and their questions and all the rest of it? Are you going to win?
At some time within the next 6 months, I expect that the Supreme Court of Tennessee will decide the case.
A very lawyerly answer. Well, John Vail, thank you very, very much for explaining all the constitutional ramifications of this very important decision that will affect all Tennesseans and may even affect people in other states if other states look to see what's happened here. So thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to my buddy John Vail for telling us about, his whole career and how recently it took him to the Tennessee Supreme Court. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.